David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 126 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Note that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges you incur. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you would like me to speak at an organization meeting that you're a member of on science, medicine, viruses, vaccination, democracy, or social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. Currently, you can donate via PayPal using david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.html for more information. Today, I'm going to talk about the case of the death of a young child and the punishment of the parents by the state, with the assistance of the medical establishment. The case occurred not far from my home in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, but the impact of the case is profound and global. And it's not over yet, so the father, David Steffen, is very brave, in my opinion, for speaking out. Another unusual aspect of this show is that the discussion was so detailed and extensive that it will extend over two episodes. This week, we will talk in detail about the last days of Ezekiel Steffen. The second episode will be about the court proceedings and ongoing appeals. But before we get to the interview, some feedback. Boris, via email, wrote, "I enjoyed your show with Peter Lavenia, who was a Green Party activist. Like many people, I've been following the U.S. elections with keen interest. I was happy to finally hear someone else mention the work that Greg Palast has done regarding election fraud, mainly to do with cross-check. It's so rare that I hear about it from any media, even from what passes for progressive media. So I wanted to thank you for that and keep up the good work. Regarding elections, there's one question I have, which I think you may be able to help me with. Recently, the last few years, I've been hearing about how exit polls aren't so accurate. Now, as far as I remember, exit polls were always considered extremely accurate. My suspicion, I have no evidence for this, is that the delegitimization of exit polling can be directly correlated to the uptick in election fraud. You've been involved with elections for some time, and I'm curious whether you have any thoughts, insights into why exit polls are recently considered to be less accurate." My answer was, regarding exit polls, I can imagine that some people might lie about who they voted for. Maybe deep down some people, maybe minorities, feel guilty voting Republican, so they walk out and report having voted Democrat, or maybe vice versa. But it would be hard to prove unless you set up a fake polling booth with people really thinking that they were voting, which would be probably illegal, or if you got permission to identify the ballots for some polling booths and then were able to identify the same people during the same exit poll, which would probably also be illegal. And if you tell people it's a fake vote for experimental purposes, they may well vote differently because it doesn't count. But I think it's also quite likely that changes are due to voting machines that aren't functioning well, that are potentially hacked through the installation of software that adds a little, subtracts a little to the vote count. It's very difficult to find out about this. During the election, after the election, the Green Party, I think very wisely, chose to try to pursue recounts in, I believe, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But they were prevented, for example, from looking at 75,000 votes in the Detroit area that were never counted. And this could account for the larger than expected vote for Donald Trump in a largely blue state and the lower vote for Hillary Clinton in the black areas of the state. Bruce Alexander, who was my guest on episode 125, in which we talked about drug addiction, after the interview wrote and told me, "I really liked your questions. Thank you for the opportunity to do this interview. It's nice to think that some of the people I interview are also happy with the show. In most cases, when I interview somebody, I really am just interested in finding out about a subject that they know about. That doesn't mean I won't ask them some tough questions if the need arises, but my purpose is not to create a drama out of the interview. It's to actually learn from some very interesting people who don't get a lot of airtime in the mainstream media. That particularly goes for today's guest. So let's get right to it. Today I'm talking to David Steffen, father of Ezekiel, who passed away in 2012 from meningitis. First of all, I'd like to offer my sympathies to you and all your family. I understand that losing a child is something no parent should have to go through. Following the death, David and his wife, Colette, were convicted of, quote, failing to provide the necessities of life. David was given jail time 4 months. Colette was sentenced to 3 months house arrest. They will both be on probation for 2 years and will have to complete 240 hours of community service. The parents are appealing, and so is the Crown, which is the Canadian name for the prosecution service. Welcome to the show, Steffen.
Hey, thank you so much, David. I appreciate you having me on here and appreciate your condolences there. You're right, you know, losing a child is an extremely tough thing. I think it's the toughest thing a parent could ever possibly go through. At least, you know, it's the toughest thing that we've ever been through by far, regardless of the circumstances that have led up to where we are today, that have left us financially depleted, indebted, and all that type of stuff. I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, having actually lost our son, which, you know, we loved absolutely dearly and miss on a daily basis, even to this day. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I started in podcasting in 2008 with a woman named Christine Maggiore. And in 2005, her daughter, who was about five, I think, died under somewhat similar circumstances. And not quite the same. In desperation, the parents, who were really not oriented towards the mainstream medical system, gave EJ an antibiotic for the first time, and then her condition dramatically worsened. But, of course, a lot of people blamed the parents. Nobody wanted to look at the treatment in the hospital. Nobody wanted to look at a possible adverse reaction to the antibiotic, things like that. But after she lost EJ, the relevant thing to this discussion is that she told me that for the time afterwards, she had great difficulty sleeping and eating because of the loss of a child. It is a devastating event.
Absolutely. You know, it's still a bit of a surprise to me that we've been able to hold on so tight, my wife and I, and get to where we are today. You know, even regardless of the circumstances with court and all that, after losing our son, there was a time there for quite a few months that were extremely, extremely dark, and we were just in a really lost and torn place. So yeah, it has a tremendous impact.
And also can be a real strain on a relationship. I mean, if the parents don't hold together, then the whole family can get ripped apart under such circumstances.
Absolutely.
It's very easy for one parent to blame the others. One can take the other side. You have other children?
We do, yes. We have an older son, Ezra, the big brother to Ezekiel, who is just about 3 years older than Ezekiel. And it's you know, a blessing that we had him first, because had we not had a son to still, you know, take care of after the passing of Ezekiel, I think circumstances would be a lot different today. And then at the time that Ezekiel passed, my wife Colette was 4.5 months pregnant.
Right.
And so 4.5 months after the passing of Ezekiel, we had another son, Ephraim, And he's just a beautiful angel, just a real pleasant child who assisted us in the healing process there. Right from the time of birth to today, he's just a real sweetheart, which goes, his personality is different than other children. Most of us are pretty rambunctious and outspoken, but he's just a real kind-hearted soul. And then we have another son that we had almost 2 years to the day later after Ephraim, and his name is Enoch. And so today he is... he's about 2.5 now, and Ephraim's about 4.5, and Ezra is 9 years old.
Yes, and they're all healthy and doing well?
They're all very healthy, healthy, doing very well. And not just in regard to, illness or anything like that. They're very smart, keen children, and we credit a lot of that to the clean diet that we have, where we avoid a lot of environmental toxins, as well as supplementation that we give them to prevent deficiencies in key nutrients, omega fatty acids, amino acids, vitamins, minerals, that type of thing.
Yes, and you live in the same province as me in the southern part of Alberta, which is known for its dramatic swings in temperature from extremely cold to extremely warm. So your body needs to be strong to withstand just going outside.
Well, absolutely. We live in an area here where it's pretty kind of small, tight-knit community, and there's a lot of illness that's going around, and we consider ourselves extremely blessed because we haven't been hit with anything that's been hitting our neighbors and whatnot that's been laying them up for a day or two at a time with, whether it be gastroenteritis, flu, cold, that type of thing. So, yeah, it requires some proactivity to prevent from getting sick with these bipolar weather swings.
Yes. So to go to the situation of Ezekiel, from what I can gather, the basic timeline seems to be that he was sick from about February 27th to March 5th, 2012, but then appeared to improve. And you and your wife treated the cough, stuffy nose, fever, etc., with alternative remedies. On March the 6th, he got worse, but then on the 7th through the 10th, he got better again. But on the 11th to 12th of March 2012, the symptoms worsened and now included stiffness. On the 13th, you picked up echinacea from a naturopath, but then later the same day, Ezekiel stopped breathing and you called an ambulance. He was taken to the Children's Hospital on the 14th and died on the 16th. Is that an accurate summary?
That's an accurate summary. It's a fairly accurate summary.
Okay, well, fill in some of the details.
This has been widely publicized, obviously, internationally, not just across the nation here. And there's varying stories depending on the agenda that the media has had and what they wanted to cherry pick for evidence. And so... just to sum it up like that, he appeared to get the croup on the 27th of February. And so for that evening, that was the only evening through the entirety of his illness that he had a fever. And, most parents don't take their child in as soon as they get sick. He started to get sick in the afternoon. And by evening, he had a cough and a bit of a fever. And so... We just treated him, using...
Or croup. Gave him... And croup is like a really hacking cough, right? A dry, continuous cough.
It's kind of a seal bark cough.
Right.
And so he had the cough for the one night, and he had the fever for the one night. But then, by the next day, so now it's a Tuesday, everything appeared normal, but the cough and the fever went away, and he appeared to just basically have a cold.
Mm-hmm. Like runny nose and stuff.
That's right, exactly. And so he had, some decreased levels of activity because of it. He didn't want to play as much and all that. But, nothing out of the ordinary for a child getting the cold. Nothing alarming, anything like that. So that persisted like a normal cold would for about 5 days, the better part of a week. And which is actually unnormal for our children because normally... they don't, like I said, pick up on the illnesses that are going around. And so, but it was a fairly normal cold, nothing that you would take your child to the doctor for, especially right. with the fact that every day he was progressively getting better. And right. I ended up going on business and came back towards the later part of the week, and he was substantially better. His levels of activity had picked up, and by weekend, we thought he was better, just basically in recovery mode. And so he was taken to preschool, I guess church first on the Sunday, on Monday, take him to school. Things appear to be almost 100% normal. I went on business trip again, and then on the Monday there, and Tuesday, he began to decline, but it appeared to just be that he was, fairly tired. No, mm-hmm. no symptoms of illness like he had before. And so I remember my wife contacting me while I was on the road and just saying, hey, I think it was too much too soon, taking him to church and taking him to preschool because he's kind of declined, and so I think he needs to get some rest. Well, I'm on business for a few days, so Wednesday rolls around one day later, and she phones me as we'd, been conversating. And says that I think that he is actually getting sick. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about it, and I said, well, if you think he's actually getting sick again, she's speculating at this point. There's nothing clear that's saying he is sick.
Right.
She's speculating, I think it could be possibly the flu. I said, well, why don't you put him back on those natural remedies that we were using before, the olive leaf extract and stuff like that. Increase vitamin C, vitamin D, that type of thing. And so she began to do that. And by Thursday, I was back home again. And when I took a look at him, I thought, just from his presence, I'm like, oh, yeah, it looks like he's getting the flu. He's got the low-lying symptoms of the flu, the early onset symptoms. And the reason why I said that is, when I first saw him, I walked into the bedroom, and he was sitting on the bed, and he was watching a movie, and there just appeared to be a presence of uncomfortableness, that I could relate with, the achiness, the stiffness that you get in your muscles and joints when you have the flu. And so that's why I speculated that, just based on his presence. But there was nothing out of the ordinary, nothing alarming. And he didn't have a fever, he wasn't throwing up, there was none of that going on. So nothing that would alarm a normal parent. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually when the stiffness, or what was deemed to be stiffness, actually first began.
And why do you say deemed to be stiffness?
Well, you can put it so many different ways. So when you're talking meningitis, stiffness is one thing, and that's alarming because, when an adult gets meningitis and they become rigid or stiff, that's something that would set off major alarm bells saying, hey, look, you got to get this individual in for treatment now.
I suppose under the circumstances, I looked up on one website, what does stiffness mean as a symptom, and they listed 268 different possible causes for stiffness. Like, I was just skiing, and so, it's pretty obvious if I woke up this morning and had been stiff all over, I wouldn't be thinking meningitis.
That's right.
But there is also drugs that can cause it, and other things. So it's not like stiffness is a symptom only of meningitis.
That's right.
But clearly, in the isolation of nothing else happening, then it can be certainly worrisome.
Exactly. And when you put it in the context of meningitis, your mental visualization is a lot different than if you put it in the context of the flu or cold. And so that's when the stiffness or the achiness of the muscles began to first appear. And so this is a Thursday. And so we continued on with the natural remedies. By Friday, there was progression. By Saturday, we thought that he was fine again and that mm-hmm. he was just now in need of rest, but that there was no symptoms of any illness. So we actually took him off the natural remedies.
Right.
So, and his symptoms were never severe in the first place. So it wasn't a substantial progression because there wasn't a big jump that needed to be taken from where he was to where in his illness to where he was when we thought he was well again on the Saturday. And so we decided not to take him to church on the Sunday because we figured, you know what, maybe he caught the flu from somebody at preschool or somebody at church when we were there the week before. Let's just, avoid contact with a lot of individuals until he is 100% well running around again. But meanwhile, we've got him off the natural treatments because we don't think that there's any concern there.
Right.
Well, Sunday rolls around, the end of Sunday. And on the Monday, I've got a meeting scheduled, a town hall meeting or a county council meeting in Southern Alberta here, where we're fighting some legislation that is very similar to what Obama put through in, I believe it was March of 2012, with the emergency management laws, or the FEMA laws, I believe, are what they are, where in the state of emergency, you lose all rights. It becomes martial law, and you lose property rights, you lose rights to yourself, you can be conscripted, you put in labor camps.
And what kind of emergencies is this law covering?
It doesn't state, that's the thing. So there's nothing that defines what an emergency is. So it could be a perceived threat, it could be perceived terrorist threat across the world, and a state of emergency could be declared. There was no restrictions. It was left pretty
wide
open.
Could it be an infectious, if somebody declares that there's an epidemic and that there's some people who are vaccinated and some aren't? I mean, would that be?
Oh, absolutely. It was left wide open. And so this was an act that was brought through the Alberta government, and it was pushed down into each municipality across the province, and we found out, when I say we, me and my brother, learned about it being on the books in certain municipalities in Southern Alberta, and we took major issue with that because we realized the risky situation that we could find ourselves in.
That's interesting that it's not a provincial legislation, it's being done municipality by municipality?
Well, it is on the books under the provincial laws. It is on the books.
And what's the name of the law?
I can't recall to this day. I mean, I haven't touched on it again just because of the association at the time.
Right. But you went to this meeting where you were opposing what the provincial government was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my brother and I actually hosted the meeting. Well, I mean, the county council hosted the meeting, but my brother and I were really the ones that put it on. Mm-hmm. We're the ones that presented before the crowd, and there was a crowd. They actually had to move us out of the standard room that they would have these meetings in and take us to a backroom shop where they could fit everybody in. They used up every chair in the place and had standing room in the back, and there was about 300 people jammed in this shop.
Right.
And so we presented the risks of this and how we felt that it wasn't necessary, that people are typically good-natured. Especially Southern Albertans, when we find ourselves in a situation, we don't need the government to step in and say, we're going to force you to help here and here and here. We take care of things. We look out for our neighbors. And so we don't need the government intervention there to remove all our rights.
It's true that there have been some major emergencies in Alberta, for example. In, I think, 2013, there was major flooding in the Calgary area. And there was tremendous community involvement in rescuing people, in cleaning up after the flood. And obviously the government was also involved in providing a lot of services during that time. And also this year there was a huge fire up in a city called Fort McMurray. And again, people all over the province welcomed refugees from Fort McMurray into their homes and gathered clothing and all of these other things. So you're right. I mean, Alberta sort of has a history of when there is an emergency, everybody helps out.
That's right. Exactly. And so, we found it, one, unnecessary, and two, quite risky if you had the wrong people sitting in those seats of authority. And so we brought it forward. And so because I was going to be presenting at this meeting, that night, the Sunday night, I went and slept in the spare bedroom, which is on the other side of the house, so that nobody could hear me when I woke up, so I wasn't interrupting them. And so I got up and I left to the meeting. It was a morning meeting. And so this is a Monday. And I come back home, and my wife is distraught. She's frustrated. She's 4.5 months pregnant. She's hormonal. No slight on her, you know, in regards to that or anything. But she's distraught because Ezekiel had taken a turn again and reverted back to about where he was on the Thursday, Friday, which was you know, the low-lying symptoms of the flu again. And she was frustrated because she was sleep-deprived about it. And and I was about to go to another meeting, but this time a work meeting. So, and I'd been spending a lot of time on the road, and so she was actually more so frustrated with me. And so,
I think I can understand.
I was,
you don't need to explain. You've been out of town. She's got a sick child. She's pregnant. Yeah, I can understand that she would be a bit frustrated if you're saying, "Okay, dear, I'm heading off to another meeting."
That's right, and don't ever let Mama Bear, who's pregnant, you know, lose any sleep, right? And
yeah,
so she lost
some
sleep, and so she's more frustrated than anything.
So
we're having a conversation over lunch before I head out to my other meeting, and she's saying, "Well, you know, he just turned back, you know, to looking like this, you know, these symptoms again, the achiness and all that type of stuff has come back, and you know, so what do we do at this point?" I said, "Well, we've taken him off the natural stuff. Let's put him back on those for sure." And during this discussion, we discussed, do we take him into the doctor? Do we not, right? Do we go sit in, you know, do we set an appointment or do we go to the emergency room and sit there for a number of hours?
And where is the closest hospital to where you live?
It's almost a half an hour drive. It'd be Cardston.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's uprooting him. And so uprooting him, taking him, having him sit, you know, in a waiting room that has a bunch of other sick children. You know, so we're trying to weigh out the risk. So what she decided to do is she had a birth attendant who was also a registered nurse, actually an emergency room nurse for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So she had tremendous experience in what we would experience if we went to the emergency room. And at that time, being 4.5 months pregnant, she was having this birth attendant come out and do basically prenatal classes with her, so prenatal checkups. And so she was about due for one anyway, so she phoned the birth attendant and said, "Hey, look, you know, could you come out today, you know, do a checkup and also take a look at, you know, our son, and just let me know what you think." And so she came out while I was at the other meeting, and I ended up coming home at, you know, later afternoon, evening, about 5 o'clock, just before supper time. And my wife was in much better spirits, which was indicative of what had taken place in the conversation. She felt very reassured after her visit with this nurse. And the nurse had checked the vitals of Ezekiel, and everything came out clear. Clear lungs, heart's good, everything. Temperature's good. And basically just said, you know, if you did take him into the emergency room, likely you'd just be turned away.
Well, and that is actually true. I interviewed somebody on this show, a woman named Jillian Skeet, who pointed out that meningitis is often misdiagnosed, and there are many cases of people who've died from meningitis who have gone to the emergency room, children or adults, gone to the emergency room, being told it's just the flu, it's just a cold, go home. And even after repeated visits, they're still told the same thing. And then the child or the adult dies of meningitis. So it certainly is possible that they would have just told you, you know, stop worrying, just go home, give them fluids, you know, deal with if there's a fever, deal with that, et cetera.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I personally know an individual who lost two of her three daughters to meningitis. And the first time brought her oldest daughter in to the hospital and was turned away, saying that it was just basically the flu. And 13 hours later, the child had a seizure and ended up dying. And so the second time that one of her other daughters, or the next time that she experienced meningitis was one of her other daughters, I believe her youngest daughter. And what took place there is she panicked, went to the hospital, and was actually saying it's meningitis because she recognized the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And she was dismissed, saying, "Look, there's no way that it would happen twice. You're just being, a neurotic mother. And by the time they caught it, that it was actually, in fact, meningitis, it was too late. So here the doctors were dismissive and just saying, look, no, there's nothing to really be concerned about. We're going to do our test. And rather than taking it seriously, they just let it kind of go until all of a sudden they realized, oh my goodness, this is meningitis. And the daughter passed away. So here you have a mother who had her first child turned away, and then the second child, even upon saying, hey, it's meningitis, still passed from meningitis because it wasn't recognized as such. So with bacterial meningitis, and the symptoms can be quite severe, it can even get overlooked. Now, in our case, there was never actually the symptoms of bacterial meningitis.
Mm-hmm. Was it ever diagnosed as a specific kind of meningitis?
Well, when we got into the Alberta Children's Hospital, the doctors attempted to diagnose it seemed to want to diagnose it as bacterial meningitis. But they were quite alarmed at the fact that he never had a fever or seizures or anything like that, that there was nothing clear-cut on the matter. And typically with bacterial meningitis, there's some pretty clear-cut symptoms.
I think we've kind of jumped over some critical. Why don't we? Yeah. You were doing really well on the timeline, and I kind of disrupted you from that. No, it's my fault.
I apologize.
What happened leading up to calling the ambulance, I guess, is okay. A pretty critical part of the story.
So I'll sum that up real quickly here. So now we're on the Monday evening. My wife is in much better spirits. She just got done visiting with the nurse. Now the nurse did bring up, without seeing him first and foremost, on her way out, she said, well, based on what's being said here, whatnot, and based on my experience in the emergency room, she decided to mention meningitis because about 2 weeks previous, somebody had come into the emergency room while she was there with meningitis,
right.
And so she brought that up and said, there's a possibility that it could be meningitis, so. Her and my wife actually went online and took a look, and well, guess what? anybody who has the flu, if they look up the symptoms of meningitis and they're trying to self-diagnose, there's a possibility that it's meningitis because the symptoms overlap. So when my wife looked at this, she said, well, there's the potential that this could be viral meningitis based on his symptoms, but he doesn't have, just like he doesn't have a lot of the symptoms of the flu, he doesn't have a lot of symptoms of meningitis, or a viral meningitis. But when it came to bacterial, it was pretty clear cut that, well, first of all, this has been off and on for 5 days. 5 days ago, he had this for a couple of days, and then it went away, and now here it is. So bacterial meningitis, typically within 48 hours, you're in a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you've got some pretty clear cut symptoms. He doesn't have those. Okay, so we proceeded saying, okay, based on the idea that there's the potential that this is viral meningitis, If he takes a turn for the worse again, we need to take him into the doctor just to be out of precaution, regardless of whether or not they'll turn us away. We just need to make sure that things are taken care of there. So that was the discussion that we had on the Monday evening after this meeting that my wife had. My father came out that evening to visit us. He went and visited with my son. We're religious, and so he gave him a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually got to observe my son. And my father has 13 children. And my father has taken us to the hospital many times growing up and whatnot, and has been able to identify when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate.
And so your father didn't bring you up with a prohibition against the mainstream medical system, although he was skeptical of some aspects, and we'll get into True Hope and the supplements later.
For sure.
So your father is not completely opposed to hospitals, even though he has some concerns about some aspects of the modern medical system?
That's correct. And so in regard to his viewing Ezekiel, there was no bias there that would lead him to not recommend us going to the hospital if he felt it was necessary. And so there was nothing that my father observed either, just like the registered nurse who saw him earlier in the day, there was nothing that either of them saw that was alarming. to indicate that, hey, you know, you need to take your son into the hospital. And so we took that as reassurance. Okay, you know, good. We got an experienced father of 13 children. We got a registered nurse who has been working in the emergency room for 10 years. And neither of them are recommending that you need to take him into the hospital. In fact, the registered nurse, like I said before, said if you take him into the hospital, there's a good chance he'll just be turned away. And so we thought, well, why expose Ezekiel to, more infectious disease if there's potential that he could pick up more stuff? Let's just keep him here for now. And if anything changes for the worse, then we'll take him in. But there's nothing alarming in his symptoms. There's nothing that appears to be, greatly concerning or anything like that. So we've got him back on the natural remedies. Olive leaf extract is the main one that we're using, which, by the way, the media refuses to report on that, but they make mention of things like smoothies with horseradish root, garlic, onion, hot peppers, which was not actually the case at all. I've never actually made a smoothie with horseradish root, garlic, hot peppers. I do put a little bit of cayenne pepper in my own personal smoothie. Just because I like the sweet and bit of heat to it.
Right.
But that's me. So that was not the case. Was there ever a tincture that we used that had horseradish root and ginger and garlic and hot peppers? Yes, there was a tincture. It wasn't the main thing that we used with Ezekiel. It was actually olive leaf extract, which there is legitimate science on showing its antibacterial, antiviral functions. He's on these remedies again, on the olive leaf extract, and Monday night rolls around, Tuesday morning comes, and he had a great sleep. He didn't have a restful sleep like he did the night before. He had a great sleep. There was improvement. We had had an appointment with the lawyers in Lethbridge on the Tuesday that we were going to cancel, and looking at his improvement, Colette and I had a discussion, my wife and I, and we thought, well, do we disrupt him? Do we not? I mean, he's made some great improvements here. How do we proceed here? Do we disrupt that? And it's kind of an important meeting. Do we postpone it? Do we not? And we thought, well, you know, if we set the stage right here, we can take him in. And so we decided, because we initially put him in the car seat when we decided that we were going to go. And I just said, look, I don't think that's the most comfortable situation for him. There was still a bit of the achiness, stiffness, that would be resemblant of what was at the flu. And, even in his best, best of scenarios, he still didn't like a car seat. And so, we decided to just take, Foamy from his crib and lay him down. And one of us would just stay in the back, and that way he could be mobile and not be constricted by a car seat.
Right.
And we went in and went to the lawyers because we are selling a house, and so we needed to sign the papers. So we went and did that. Now, during this, as part of our conversation, we said, well, you know, there has to be benefit for Ezekiel. We made sure that all the supplements were packed. We had electrolyte drinks and stuff like that we were giving him, just to ensure that he was topped up with fluids. He had had his smoothie as well. That typical smoothie that we make for him on a daily basis anyways had greens in there, just a good nutritious smoothie. And so we had all this stuff packed, but we thought, well, if we're going to Lethbridge anyways, we might as well, just further improve his health by going and getting an echinacea tincture as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the naturopath comes in, that we went to the naturopath just and used her as a storefront, not in a capacity of a naturopathic doctor. She didn't see him.
I see.
And so and so she's actually come under fire, but it would be the same thing as if we went to a health food store and just picked up.
You could have gone to a major grocery chain because they sell echinacea there, right?
That's right. Exactly. So it really has.
And that they wouldn't blame Safeway for what happened next, right?
Exactly. We could have done it anywhere. You're absolutely right. And so it's got nothing to do with her as a naturopathic doctor or anything. And so my wife went and picked that up while we were in Lethbridge. And, it was actually quite substantial, the benefits that we saw from the time that we left our house, drove an hour to Lethbridge, Went to Lethbridge, signed the papers, went and got the echinacea tincture, went to the grocery store, and my wife just had to pick up just a couple things, so she left me in the vehicle, and there's me lying in the back with my son Ezekiel, and Ezra's in the back as well, and we'd unbuckled him at that point because we're in the parking lot, and so he's playing in the back of the SUV, and I fell asleep during this process and woke up to my son Ezekiel playing with my lip, doing a little flap type of thing while he's beside me. And so I noticed at that point that all the symptoms that he had completely subsided. Mm-hmm. Any resemblance of stiffness or achiness or, being sick was almost 100% gone at that point. We drove home, where he ended up having a very restful nap, got home, and by this point, we're looking at mid-afternoon, and I take him into our bedroom where I was going to lie him down, and we had our electrolyte drink that we'd made for him, and he drank about a full cup of it on his own, and so he's drinking on his own. So this dispels the media's where they're saying that he had to be fed through an eyedropper. Never at any point did he have to be fed through an eyedropper. My wife's extremely proactive, and so if a child refuses to take liquids, and she'll come in with the eyedropper and just continually just drop liquids in. And so at some point, yes, we did do that, and we did that with maple syrup and water. That's where the maple syrup treatment for bacterial meningitis comes up in the media as well. Had nothing to do with illness. It was a matter of getting him good electrolytes, sugars into him. My wife is very proactive that way. And so he didn't require that, though. He drank about a cup of this electrolyte drink on his own, went down for a very restful nap, had no sign. You can tell when a child is sick when they're sleeping, just in the way that they present themselves, the way they posture, their mouth open for increased respiration and whatnot. All that was gone. And so we thought the next day he is going to be fine, that this is where we are in our mindset. Mm-hmm. My wife actually, she wasn't going to go initially, but she goes to this church activity because she didn't feel that there was anything that she needed to be home for. And so I was left home, and I would go and check up on him, about every half an hour type of thing, 15 minutes, half an hour, as he's sleeping and having this restful sleep. Well, he's still looking restful. He wakes up. I give him some fluids, and he begins to develop this kind of breathing pattern. And so my wife phones just to ask, hey, how's he doing? And I said, well, he's doing fine, but he's got kind of this rhythm to his breathing. And so anyway, she decided to come home, which surprised me because I said, there's nothing to be alarmed about or anything. It's just kind of, curious. He's just kind of got this rhythm to his breathing. But everything, he seems fine. He's cognizant. When he woke up, he went back down for his nap. Everything's fine. Like there's, symptoms are still gone, but there's this rhythm to his breathing. So she decided to come home. And I'm sure glad she did, because it was a very short period after that he went into respiratory arrest, stopped breathing. Quite rapidly, and so we phoned 911, and I had to run out, living in the country, I had to run out to the end of the driveway to give them the number on the county number on our property, so that the ambulance would be able to find us.
Right.
I run back into the house and find that he's breathing again. Colette had him lying on the bed, and he was breathing on his own, and turns out that that Colette had patted him on the back a few times, and he had coughed up some mucus and began breathing on his own again. And his breathing was fine. Like, well, it still sounded, because you can hear it in the 911 call, that there's some restrictiveness to it, but there's no breathing pattern or anything like that at this point. And so, anyways, I tell 911, because I'm thinking, oh, they're dispatching from Cardston. And they were dispatching from Cardston, which was half an hour away. And I'd heard the horror stories about how the ambulance services have trouble finding people in the rural. And it turns out there was actually a report that came out from this time period. It came out in March 2013 that showed that that was exactly the case when Alberta Health Services took over the ambulance services, that people in the rural communities were in dangerous situations. And so, anyways, I'd heard about these horror stories.
Which is why you wanted to make sure that this number that uniquely identifies your property was given to them so that they couldn't go to the wrong place.
I'd still heard the horror stories about even when you give that number, how they're having trouble finding it. And so, anyways, he's breathing again, and I tell them this, and I'm in a state of shock. I'm thinking, what just made him stop breathing? Because here he'd gone symptom free, so I'm not linking it to the illness or anything. I'm legitimately completely confused based on what we've seen. And so, anyways, I don't know if I just phoned 911 when it didn't require being phoned, because he coughed up mucus and led us to believe, well, maybe he had just aspirated on some of the liquid that I'd given him, and now he's fine. But right. So Colette and I have, so I said, well, maybe we'll just drive him in. I didn't know what to do at this point. I'm in a state of shock, and right. I wished that, you know, the person that the 911 respondent could recognize that, because I'm sure they get calls from people that are going through traumatic situations all the time, and that they're not necessarily in the best state of mind based on the trauma, that they would have taken control and said, okay, well, it's protocol that when a child stops breathing, even if they're breathing fine, we send out an ambulance to make sure oxygen levels are fine and all that. And we've heard that from actually an emergency respondent saying, hey, that's protocol. They should have sent the ambulance anyways.
So you'd called 911. So did you call back and say you didn't need the ambulance?
No, I was still on the phone with them and came back into the house and was shocked he's breathing again. Like, and so I'm thinking, oh, sorry for troubling you. I've never had to phone 911 before. I don't, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, he's symptom free and all that. Like, was this just, did it just panic? Like, yeah, he stopped breathing, but did he just, you know,
I understand. So then what happened? I mean, did the ambulance come or?
No. So they didn't dispatch the ambulance. They said, okay, yeah, just take him into the hospital. Basically that was the end of the conversation.
So you drove into Cardston at that point.
That's right. So then we went and so I woke up my 4-year-old son and went and got him into the vehicle. And we went and took the crib mattress back out to the vehicle, laid down the seat so that he could lie down in the back there with my wife. And so we began to drive.
Mm-hmm.
So we got about a mile into the drive.
Yeah.
And he stopped breathing again. And we're driving straight east from our house, which is going to take us through Glenwood and then on to Cardston. And so we phoned 911 again. And, I said, hey, look, I just got off the phone with you guys about my son not breathing. He's not breathing again. And, just tried to quickly identify where we were at so they knew where to meet us. And here we are, you know, we're talking 2012. I've got an iPhone. It's got the GPS enabled. 911 services, as far as I'm aware at this time, has full capability of being able to track a phone. To see where we are location-wise.
They should be able to, yes.
And so here we are, we're driving, we're 3 miles west of Glenwood, we're driving towards Glenwood, and turns out there's an ambulance in Glenwood all along. That was only 5 minutes down the road from us. I wasn't aware of it, but they could have dispatched that, and they would have been to our house before we were even done packing our children up into the vehicle to get going.
That is pretty incredible. So they had an ambulance. So you get to Glenwood, and then did that ambulance take over?
No. We weren't aware of it. They didn't dispatch it. We drove within 100 meters of it. We could have met up with the ambulance there at about the time that the respondents would have been to the ambulance. Now, the reason why I know this is I actually began volunteering for the fire department in Glenwood. I started doing training with them shortly after this and discovered... One, they had an ambulance. Two, they were available that evening.
Ambulance normally was stationed in Glenwood to presumably service that part
right.
of the country.
And it was stationed there that night, and there was emergency respondents available to man the ambulance, and they never got a call.
Yeah, because it's not just a form of transportation, but, I mean, the paramedics, certainly if a child stops breathing or something, are trained to deal with that situation, right?
That's
CPR
right.
or whatever is necessary to...
Well, exactly. They've got the equipment to intubate, to get an airway, and that's the first thing that they do when they have a patient that needs air. Is they will intubate, they'll get an airway. That's the first goal, and then get things stabilized from there. And so here, my wife's doing CPR in the back of our vehicle, and we drive within 100 meters of where this ambulance is.
But at that time, you did not know there was an ambulance within 100 meters.
I had no idea.
You had no idea.
And so we continue on to Cardston, driving at a very, very fast rate. Mm-hmm. And we end up getting almost all the way to Cardston, probably within about 5 kilometers of Cardston. So at the rate that we were driving, it was probably about another 3 or 4 minutes, if that, to get to the actual hospital there. And so that's about the point that we met up with the ambulance on the highway. And so typically Cardston's about a 25, 30-minute drive. And so our son had been going about 11 minutes without air or without oxygen on his own, other than the CPR that my wife was giving him. And at that point, she was asked by the 911 respondent, is he getting air? And there was some kind of gargling, which signified that there is an obstruction in the airway, which has nothing to do with bacterial meningitis, by the way.
He could have swallowed a marble or something.
Well, he could have more mucus, right? He already coughed up mucus and started breathing on his own. Did he have more mucus that he had just aspirated on? We don't know. And maybe we'll never know, but that seems to be what prevented him from breathing, is the fact that he had an obstruction in his airway. And so it was the first time, and it appeared to be the second time based on the sound when he was getting air into his lungs from CPR. So we met up with the ambulance. We ended up, the paramedic came and took our son out of the back of the vehicle, and they brought him into the ambulance and began standard protocols of trying to get an airway and whatnot. Well, we weren't allowed in the ambulance, and it was about 8 minutes from the time that they picked him up. It was actually just over 8 minutes to the time that they would have gotten to the hospital. And it seemed like more like a year, though.
I can imagine.
Situation. When we got to the hospital, he was completely non-responsive whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just left in a state of confusion. Well, it was later on that we discovered, and actually it was later on when we got into the court system, that we discovered that the ambulance was destocked, proactively destocked. It didn't just run out of equipment. It was proactively destocked of certain equipment that was required for a child under the age of 8 to get an airway. So here's the situation. Alberta Health Services takes over the ambulance service.
Right.
And when they do, this particular ambulance had equipment pulled out of it. The paramedic who manned the ambulance was aware of the situation and had made multiple recommendations that they needed to get that equipment back into the ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
His request fell on deaf ears until this situation took place.
And now it's being rectified?
It was rectified within 1 week. It had gone over a year of not being rectified. Within 1 week of the passing of our son, that ambulance was outfitted with the proper equipment to get an airway for a child, a toddler. So if it wasn't our son that ended up in the ambulance and went over 8 minutes without oxygen, because he did, he went 8 minutes, 11 seconds without any oxygen whatsoever in that ambulance.
Right, because all they could do at that point, it was just a form of transportation. They were just going to get him to the hospital.
That's exactly it, right? So but they weren't giving him CPR. So it would have been better that he would have stayed in our vehicle and my wife continued to give him CPR over the next couple minutes while we got to the hospital than to hand him over to the ambulance and him get no oxygen. And while they're trying to get an airway, it's delayed in getting to the hospital. So now he goes for over 8 minutes without any oxygen whatsoever, which by many, many experts is brain death.
Right.
So, which is the one sure thing that we know in regard to this case, that was what he had, was brain death. Now, what was it caused from? There's some that are speculating, bacterial meningitis, but there's no scientific evidence to actually back that up. And so what we do know is that the ambulance didn't get him any air for eight minutes, 11 seconds, and then that would cause brain death. And so within 1 week, that ambulance is outfitted. And, you know, the one thing that people are missing, because they're saying, how dare you blame the ambulance? You should have never needed the ambulance. You should have taken him into the doctor first and foremost. Okay, well, you could say that with almost every situation that a child ends up in. If they end up in an ambulance, you should have not let your child play on the playground up that high and fall off and conk their head,
Well, let's go back to February 27th. I mean, let's say that, you know, Ezekiel gets sick, you rush into the hospital on the first day. Well, clearly it couldn't have been meningitis on February 27th because it doesn't take that long to develop. So they would have told you to go home at that point.
That's right.
And if it was meningitis, like, it must have developed fairly late in this process.
That's right.
And I mean, it's pretty easy to second guess the situation, but I mean, you could have been back and forth to the hospital 10 times with them telling you, no, it's not meningitis. But that would presuppose that you knew that it was going to be meningitis at some point in the future.
Yes, that's right. And so there actually was, you know, to jump ahead a little bit here, actually quite a bit ahead, what did come out in court after we hired an independent, the former chief medical examiner of Alberta, when we hired her to take a second look at this, what she found is there was no scientific evidence whatsoever to say it was bacterial meningitis. In fact, there was missing reports and everything that they were referencing. They couldn't be found. We couldn't find the actual reports that showed that there was testing for bacterial meningitis, and yet they referenced these reports. But what she did find is that there was in fact evidence of viral meningitis. But now to the average person, they say, well, bacterial and viral, what difference does it make, right? That's an extremely severe illness. Well, the fact of the matter is, according to the chief medical examiner, she says nobody dies from viral meningitis. Virtually nobody dies from it. She says in the odd case that they go into respiratory arrest because of it, if you intubate them, they have nearly a 100% chance of full recovery with no issues.
Yes. At this point, we have a decision to make. I'm running out of time for one show, and we haven't even got into the court case. So if you have another hour, we can keep talking, and I can do two shows out of this.
Well, I would say let's do it, because there is...
still to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about in regards specifically to his illness in the case, but then there's also... There's a whole government media agenda here that's starting to show forward.
I agree. Thank you for listening to episode 126 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. And remember, next week I will be running the second part of the interview with David Steffen, so make sure you listen. Until next week, goodbye.